From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in April in Ukraine, where Volodymyr Zelensky, the actor who played Ukraine's president on a political satire show called Servant of the People, was elected to become Ukraine's actual president. What's more, the 41-year-old comedian and Instagram star won 73% of the popular vote. Zelensky's campaign was presented in some ways like a reality show, with the actor posting videos of himself working out of the gym and taking selfies with fans. He told the BBC that the people of Ukraine want to see a president with strong morals and values, like the character he played on the sitcom Servant of the People. He has promised his followers, quote, a life without corruption, without bribes, end quote. And that matters everywhere, but in particular, in Ukraine. Political analysts say voters who were tired of war and economic hardship rallied behind him to push out the political establishment. The swamp, if you like. Zelensky's victory is the latest among political outsiders, harnessing the power of media to spread a populist message. But critics ask if Zelensky has what it takes to lead a country that is still establishing itself as a democratic and independent state. In this hour, we examine the state of Ukrainian independence and democracy with this new president in place. And we're also going to talk general messaging, populism, promises to voters, the kinds of themes that we hear sometimes in the United States, Ukraine, and elsewhere. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. Elena Prokopovich. Dr. Prokopovich is a professor of political science at Nazareth College. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Randy Stone is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good to be here, Evan.
And Grant Koss is a professor of communication with a focus on rhetoric at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He drained the swamp to be with us today. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
So I'm going to start with you, Elena, and I admit, you know, we've talked a lot. You and I have talked. I've talked to Randy over the years, trying to kind of stay current on what's happening in Ukraine, and it feels like every year or two there is a crisis of corruption, that the people of Ukraine have been sort of just feeling bereft of hope that they could have leadership without corruption. And here we have another promise of a life without corruption, a life without bribes. Generally speaking, you know, what's your take from, at least from the lens now that you have here in the United States, looking at what's happening in Ukraine?
So corruption is certainly the issue that is central to the political aspirations of the Ukrainian people. But it's certainly not the only one. War that Russia has brought to Ukraine is certainly another very important issue, general issue of deepening democracy, deepening the ties with the European Union is also up there. Yet corruption has become a rallying cry for those who have come out in force, as you have said, 73% to support then-candidate Zelensky. And then for, again, a majority of Ukrainian electors who voted his party, Servant of the People, to take the historically high proportion, outright majority, in Ukrainian parliament, the Verkhovna Rada. So corruption has become amplified as an issue. What's interesting to me, Evan, is that if we look at data on corruption, in the last couple of years, the perception of corruption, according to various polls, has improved. In other words, Ukrainians polled by a variety of organizations say that corruption has lessened. And yet, in this election, corruption has once again, I think, become the Trump card, if you will. And I think it carried the election to where it has carried it with the absolutely astonishing results. I think we could distinguish between levels of corruption and the rate at which corruption is being fought as two different and somewhat independent variables here. People may say the corruption has lessened, but they're overall not happy with the rate at which the corruption is being combated and eradicated in Ukraine. And it is a very, very well-entrenched issue, which makes promises, easy promises of overcoming it, rather suspicious and populist in their tone.
Dr. Stone, what are the first lessons you take away from the elections and the results so far in Ukraine this year?
Well, the most interesting thing was that we had no idea who was going to win. I mean, if you'd asked me last year, and maybe you did, maybe you could rewind the tape and get my predictions. I think
to protect you, I decided not to do that.
My guess is I would have said probably Poroshenko would win. He was the incumbent. He had all the tools that you can use to manipulate these things. But it was a very clean election. Maybe it would be Yulia Tymoshenko, who was the former prime minister and was a very controversial figure, but she seemed to be his primary opponent in the election. And Zelensky kind of came out of nowhere as a political neophyte, comedian, television star, and so forth. It's interesting that after they each won about a third of the vote in the first round, and then there were lots of other candidates who won, small proportions. And then in the second round, mm-hmm. it was just overwhelming. I think the second round was an overwhelming rejection of Petro Poroshenko rather than really an embrace of Zelensky. Nobody has any idea what he really stands for. I mean, aside from his position as a comic and so forth. But Poroshenko did not command a lot of loyalty after 5 years of war with Russia, which, of course, drained his popularity, and perceptions that his economic management wasn't very effective. So Ukraine is still an incredibly poor country. Its GDP per capita is lower than Algeria. So this is, and then they're going into their negotiations for yet another IMF bailout with all the sort of reform agenda still in place that needs to be carried out.
So what is the American analog, by the way? This is a 41-year-old actor who was playing a president on a TV show who becomes the actual president. What's the analog in this country? Who would it be? Somebody on SNL? Is that who the analog would be?
Probably, yeah. Right? I would say it would be somebody from SNL.
So...
Wing and not the House of Cards, right?
Yeah. No. History is revisiting the West Wing, but I don't know. Grant, when you look at the actual rhetoric there, it feels familiar when you hear about ending corruption, draining the swamp, and it's powerful. Obviously, that's a powerful card to play in an election in which nobody gets 73%. And to Randy's point, he didn't get 73% in the first go-around. Mm-hmm. He did in a later runoff. But still, nobody gets that number unless there's a galvanizing force behind this idea that voters in Ukraine and in the United States, et cetera, these themes seem to be powerful no matter where you go, no matter just how cynical people may feel.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think there's something about populism as a frame there's the people and the elite, and maybe you go from culture to culture to culture, but it still is there, and it's a powerful frame in which you can have political action. And to one of the points that Randy made, I would wonder, stating that Zelensky, that persons didn't really know him. I think you might be able to say that they did know him through the program, mm-hmm. Servant of the People, which was not a situation comedy, but I guess a series that has run for about 2 years. We were talking about it beforehand. I think you can find it on Netflix. And the persons did know him just as, if we do want to look at an analog to our current leader, Donald Trump. I mean, Americans did sort of know him through The Apprentice, through his time on that television program. So in terms of a mediated program, these characters, I would say that people probably did know Zelensky, but as a character, and how he will be as a leader still is the...
So before we kind of pivot back to Ukraine, let's get meta for a second, because when you say they knew him, there's a couple of different layered meanings to what it means to know somebody.
Right.
You can know of somebody, the Q rating, so to speak. How much does the public recognize a name or know a name? You can know a celebrity through movies or what you see sort of ephemerally through your screens. But it also doesn't mean that you know him or her, or know him or his or her ideas on how to govern. So the idea that the Ukrainian people might have felt like they knew Zelensky is one thing, And then I'm thinking of what Gia Tolentino recently told Ezra Klein in a podcast about our performance culture now. Everything is performative. When we post on Twitter or Facebook, it's performative. When you post for your family on Facebook and you post all the beautiful suburban life pictures, it's performative. When you post political statements on Twitter, it's performative. So it's hard to really know what it means to know somebody, I guess is what I'm saying. But do you think people can know someone enough to say, well, that person's well-known. He could win an actual election. He could get 73% in an election.
I don't know that. I think we can say that people know a character. I would probably take from the ideas of New York Times television critic a couple of weeks ago had a piece in the Sunday paper where he argued to understand our president, Donald Trump, you need to understand him as a television character, and that know him as a character, not as the, you know, as pundits over the last couple of years saying, you know, he'll come into this office and he'll grow, he'll become presidential, just know him as a character.
That was the worst American punditry of all the bad American punditry. Today's the day he became president, you would hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
He's growing into the role.
Yeah. I guess I would say that we can know him as a character and kind of evaluate him in that way.
But is that healthy that we are now in a situation where entire countries are electing Zelensky, and again, I am not an expert on Zelensky at all, but Zelensky, Donald Trump, people, and you know, now you have some on the left, and again, not necessarily widespread, going, well, how about Oprah? I mean, it's this idea that you want to put somebody with a high Q rating up there, maybe because they're not elite, though of course Donald Trump is, you know, if nothing else, he is part of the American elite. But, you know, it's this idea of what our standards are for electability, and they do seem to be changing in certain ways.
Yeah.
Or no?
Well, I mean, I think one important function of elections is it gives an opportunity to kick the bums out, right? And so democratic institutions have a minimalist sense of how they function and what they should be good for is giving that opportunity. And this election did that in the sense it provided an opportunity to give a negative verdict on the previous government. And a lot of political scientists think that that's what elections really are about. They're retrospective. They're about the current incumbent. Yes, it's a little disturbing if the political institutions, the party system, and so forth, don't generate credible, attractive candidates to run against the incumbent. And there are all sorts of reasons why that might be the case. And Ukraine's political culture has been in such turmoil that it's, I think, not too surprising that the most prominent alternatives were deeply compromised people, yeah. And then it took somebody who was a political neophyte to provide an alternative to that.
Well, and so, Dr. Prokopovich, do you feel like we know enough about Zelensky to offer a verdict on whether this is a sort of a precarious or dangerous thing to do for a country to say, well, there's a 41-year-old comedian who we know through television, and what he wants to be as an actual president is sort of what he played on TV, and that sounds better than the current bum, so let's do it. I mean, is that dangerous to you, or do you think, look, I mean, the whole political system has been beset by corruption. It's understandable.
I think there are reasons to worry about these developments all over the world, in Ukraine in particular, but in the United States as well. But first, we have to acknowledge some realities, which is that in an increasingly mediated age where parts of electorate prefer non-traditional ways of communication, seeing videos, seeing posts, knowing their candidate in the role of an ordinary, more ordinary person outside of the political establishment. The kinds of candidates that Zelensky and Trump represent do have an advantage. They have a whole history of appearing in the public sphere, in the media and entertainment sphere, and establishing following, and then capitalizing on those followings, which is why, of course, Oprah or somebody else's name could be brought up into this conversation. So we have to, live with this reality. We have to own this reality. Politicians, on the other hand, have significant disadvantages. Those who have been in the public eye for a long time They are most likely mired in either unpopular decisions or even suspicions of corruptions in certain dealings that are not the prettiest side of politics, that electorate is impatient about. And so there's an uneven playing field almost. And to get back to what Grant was saying about whether we know, whether Ukrainian voters had a feeling of knowing the candidate Zelensky, I would add that it's not only The Servant of the People as a show, which is fairly recent. Uh-huh. It's a 3 to 4 year run, right? Mm-hmm. But it is almost a 20-year career as a comedian of a weekly, very successful, very popular, mm-hmm. steady show that grew out of humor traditions in the late Soviet Union, then transformed into post-independence type of humor that brought Mr. Zelensky to the TV screens and the households all over Ukraine, and certainly established an image, fairly warm one, for a lot of Ukrainians who culturally are cynical of governments, therefore appreciate humor that is political and constant and kind of unrelenting. And that was what Kartal 95 offered to Ukrainians. I do think, however, that it is a concerning development when we have presidents with no political experience, when in a country such as Ukraine, which already which has rather immature party systems, in which parties form not around ideas or longstanding aspirations or ideologies, but rather they already have been forming around the personality of a leader or particular goals of a leader, to add to that an entirely inexperienced personality that catapults itself to the highest office in the country is certainly a worrisome development for Ukraine as well as for other countries.
Well, let me just read a little bit of feedback already. One of our listeners via Twitter says, talking about electing actors playing presidents, Martin Sheen, a la Jed Bartlett from The West Wing, would probably actually get my vote. another listener from Ohio reminds me that it was 2 years ago that it was predicted if LeBron James decided to run for governor of Ohio, he probably would win. And that is not a joke. We've heard over the years, especially when he was still active on Comedy Central, there are plenty of calls for Jon Stewart to run for something. And Jon Stewart's probably a decent analog to what we're seeing in Zelensky, right? I mean, is that fair?
It is, but if somebody has warm feelings for Jon Stewart, one doesn't want to make those analogies too easily.
Okay, but the bottom line is we have seen these kind of calls before for this person should run, this person should run. But most of the time that doesn't happen. And now it seems to be actually happening more often. And before we kind of get into what it actually means to be elite, because I have an interesting email I want to read. Randy, when you think about a relative neophyte in politics in the leadership position in Ukraine, the concern about getting fleeced or worse by someone like Putin, what comes to mind? What is a worst case scenario, even for someone, let's assume Zelensky's well-intended here. What's the worst case scenario?
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been a lot of interesting developments just in the last week in Ukrainian-Russian relations. And we have a prisoner exchange that happened a week ago, which a lot of interesting details about that. But it was widely seen, I think, as a positive development in terms of breaking the ice and perhaps moving towards some progress in their long-term stalemate. There have been statements on both sides about possible beginning again of the Normandy format talks, which would be Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany meeting in Paris, perhaps in late September, perhaps in October, perhaps only after certain preconditions have been met by one side or the other, right? So it's not clear whether that will actually happen. And there have been some sort of preconditions met in terms of sort of strengthening the Ukrainian bargaining position by the EU and the United States in the last week, too. So suggests that, well, maybe this is moving in a positive direction for the first time in about 5 years, because it was really, in a deadlock. And Putin was determined not to make a deal with Poroshenko. So maybe just the fact that there's someone new at the helm makes it possible for him to rethink his strategy and perhaps restart something. On the other hand, yes, there's a lot of danger that he gets into a room with all these experienced politicians and he ends up making a deal which is very bad for Ukraine. It's hard to see anyone extracting a deal that's really good for Ukraine in the current situation, given all the circumstances. But yes, there's a lot of concern about that. And even, you know, members of his own government have been raising concerns that, you know, it's going to be really tough for him.
Elena, you agree at least there that it's hard to see good deals coming for Ukraine right now with the current state of affairs with Russia?
It is. So long as Putin is in power, analysts seem to gravitate towards the opinion that Ukraine, domination of Ukraine, will be the goal, not just small goals of, you know, possible water supply for Crimea or something like this, but as much as possible, the return of Ukraine to a much more subordinate, you know, position vis-a-vis Russian agenda. And to add to what Randy was saying, Zelensky and his party have promised so much so quickly that there is a fear that they must deliver now before they lose the interest and the confidence and the euphoria of their elections. And in the haste of needing to deliver, they will score points for which they pay very dearly in terms of giving up on essential Ukrainian interest. And this exchange of prisoners already raised that possibility. Among the exchange prisoners mm-hmm. was Volodymyr Tsemakh, who is considered right. to be one of the key witnesses in the ongoing criminal international investigation of the downing of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine. Now, we have been assured in the press that both European and Ukrainian investigators had a chance one more time to take depositions of this particular witness before he was released to Russia and eventually returned to the territories not controlled by Ukraine. But for many, this was a very high price to pay, possibly a price worth a much cooler attitude of the Netherlands and European Union altogether towards Ukraine as you know, a place that concerns itself with the interests of the victims and the families of the flight. So that isn't one example where quick victories may be gained at very high cost.
So sometimes there's a desire to sort of confirm through early actions that everything you promised you could do. Say, getting close to Kim Jong-un, or the kinds of things that we have even seen this White House do, an attempt to say that we're different, that we're deal makers, that things are going to be different. It does seem analogous, at least to me. But Barry writes to say, Evan, you and your guests are mistaking what elite actually means. It doesn't just mean that you have money. It means that you are someone with a decision-making power over the rest of the people, and the people are tired of it. In this country, it's Democrats and Republicans. Overseas, I'm not sure of all the dynamics of the political parties, but I would guess it is something similar, and they are looking to throw it back in the face of the elites. Let's go around the table. I'll start with you, Grant. When you hear about the word elite, Barry is saying that we go, well, Donald Trump's part of the elite. He's, you know, he's got a few million dollars, maybe even a few tens of millions of dollars. Who knows? I haven't seen his tax returns. How could he not be in the elite of this? Barry is saying elite doesn't just mean money. It means people want to throw it in the face of the elite, and Donald Trump was the vehicle to throw it in the face of the elite, and we're going to see that in Ukraine, and we're going to see that maybe in France, and we're going to see that in other places. How do we define elite?
I think that Barry's onto something, at least in American culture, that elite, it doesn't have to mean that you're from kind of a moneyed background or privilege. You're a real estate person from New York City. I think that, you know, as long as you can identify, it's understanding that that binary between the people and an elite, and if you can identify with the people, kind of the common person, that elite can be, you know, as the caller mentions, it can be Democrats and Republicans or people who are running things right now. A do-nothing Congress. It can really be kind of a diverse. But yeah, those people who are having power, they don't have to be kind of the elite in terms of being rich or anything.
Okay, so is Trump elite? Maybe by some means, yes, and in some situations,
I would say, yeah, in some ways. But in terms of his particular populist style and his discourse, I think he tries to, he projects himself as kind of an anti-elite, I would say.
And again, even though that may be performative, it goes back to what Tolentino and Ezra Klein were saying. Sometimes performative becomes reality, especially if people accept that. And so what's elite to you? What do you make of Barry's point there, Randy?
Yeah, I guess I think that elite is something that has so many different definitions that it's become not a very useful term in public discourse. We have to really pin down what we're talking
sometimes
about.
Sometimes people mean the academy. Sometimes they mean the government,
Right. Are we talking about the 1% economically? Or are we talking about people with more than a high school education? Or are we talking about, the foreign policy elite, members of the Council on Foreign Relations, like myself, who get together periodically and hobnob about these things? They mean different things. But there is in American political culture, this deep-seated hostility towards elites and sort of feeling that there is somehow in tension with the common person, which goes back to the founding of the Republic and the election of Andrew Jackson and so forth. And this is a long-standing tradition in our political culture. I don't think that's a universal. I think that other countries have very different traditions and different ways of relating to education, for example, than the U.S. public does. But populism also is not quite the same thing as anti-elitism, right? And it also comes in different flavors. Mm-hmm. So there's a version of populism which is sort of xenophobic and connected with opposition to immigration and so forth, which is very popular right now, in the United States and across Europe. But that's not particularly associated with Zelensky, as far as I can tell. I mean, he's the first Jewish president of Ukraine, and he hasn't been associated with that kind of and there isn't particularly any concern about immigration in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. More the concern is about emigration from Ukraine because people are leaving for economic reasons. So that's very different. And in this particular matchup between Poroshenko and Zelensky, Poroshenko was the hardliner who was kind of selling the conflict against Russia to try to bolster his flagging political prospects because the economy wasn't doing well, right? And he was the one who was kind of pushing the split between the Ukrainian and Russian Orthodox churches and so forth, and sort of pushing all the buttons to use that conflict politically. So that seems kind of like populist foreign policy to me. So it's hard to pin down exactly who the populist is. On the other hand, Zelensky is the one who's saying, let's, throw out the bums. I haven't been shown to be corrupt, so therefore I'm clean, right? Which doesn't necessarily follow, but at
the
least—
absence of discernible corruption, he wants to say, is evidence of cleanness, purity.
Absolutely.
Mm. Okay.
And that's the oldest, trick in the book too, right? You run against corruption and you run against the bad, the sort of identifiable bad pattern of policy of your predecessor, and you say, well, I'm going to do something different. It's going to be new, and well, that motivates people if the status quo is pretty bad.
But what worries me, Elena, is whether it's in Ukraine or really any place where the dynamics are such that the voters are so feeling beset with corruption that they will elect a 41-year-old comedian or a reality TV star. If that person gets mired in corruption, is at some point the public is going to feel, and maybe we've reached well past that point in certain voting populations, where people just feel that there is no really viable choice that isn't corruptible. That the system is so inevitably corrupted that whoever you put in there is going to, and that's what I worry about in this case with Zelensky. I mean, I don't know much about him, but boy, he better be the person that he claims to be, because Ukrainians, I can't imagine, would feel very hopeful if he has the scandal, if he has the Yanukovych-style mansions, etc. How do you feel about that?
Well, hope dies last. And I'm actually less worried maybe than you are, Evan, about this situation. I think Ukrainian voters, as well as voters in other countries, have miraculously been able to believe that the next leader will do better in terms of fighting corruption than the previous 4, 5, 10 that have promised the same thing but then inevitably failed. But certainly, I think there is an accumulation of cynicism and maybe despair and disappointment, which can, over time, damage political culture, democratic political culture. And yes, one has to worry about if this one fails as well after such a wave of enthusiasm, what would the level of the damage be? Now, Ukrainians have, in their post-independence history, have gone through, depending on how you count, three or four revolutions. So Ukrainians do have a plan B, Maidan, as it were, another one, and that one is regularly promised if this government does not deliver. And yet it is hard to see how the very well-entrenched, really deeply entrenched corruption that undergirds the interests of multiple oligarchs who cannot make income other than on the schemes that involve preferential treatment or preferential acquisition of government property or use of public and large, you know, resources. It's very hard to see how these oligarchs and these forces can be weaned away from their main way of making money and living and protecting their wealth overnight or even in the short run. Some ideas like amnesty for illegal enrichment up to this point and then strong enforcement of anti-corruption measures and tools has been proposed, and maybe that will work. We'll have to see. We do not know. But to come back to the point that was sounded by both Grant and Randy, when we're talking about populism in Ukraine, things are different from other countries in a variety of ways. For example, populism in Ukraine does not have an ability to latch on to some of the more predictable themes that we see in Europe and in the United States. Immigration, for example, is not a big issue, so you cannot take the out-group immigrants or recent immigrants or potential immigrants and make them scapegoats in a traditional sense. To Ukrainian politicians, another form of populism or populist rhetoric is not available, and that is to be Euroskeptics, which is very typical way of the populist rhetoric in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. European Union is our hope at this point, or for not everybody, but for a large swath of population, it is the hope to get away from Russia and into the European Union. So that mode of populism is not available. With it, what's not available is the form of populism that we see here, which then takes a liberal elite, or creates rather the object called liberal elite, and then weds it to illegal immigrants and multiculturalism and other such objects and builds the populism on that rhetoric. That type of populism is not available to Zelensky, again, for a number of structural and even personal reasons, as you said, Randy. So, and that gladdens me because I think the most pernicious, the most ugly forms of populism are simply not available on the menu of current Ukrainian political culture. Corruption is available. The resentment against prior members of parliament, president, high officials is available. And that becomes the core argument for Ukrainian populism, such as it exists with Zelensky. Luckily, other forms are not in the offing.
After our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and we're going to turn this conversation back to the United States for a moment, because when we talk about elite and we talk about why a 41-year-old actor in Ukraine who played Ukraine's president on a political satire show goes on to be elected Ukraine's actual president, and why a reality star wins, and people talk about, well, throw it in the face of the elite. Who is not elite if not Volodymyr Zelensky or Donald Trump or Jon Stewart or Oprah? I mean, are these not the elite? To the notion that there is a different way to think about this, we're going to talk about what it would actually mean in the United States to govern in a way that is anti-elite, and what that might look like in practice as we sort of learn some of these lessons. And we're also going to talk about the idea of jailing people who have been corrupt? Because it's a sensitive question in Ukraine, for example. Just as in the United States, President Obama decided not largely to put hardly anybody in jail for the financial crisis, the previous, the Bush administration, torture, all kinds of things. He thought this was not the way to do this. And in Ukraine, it's a sensitive question. Should we put people in jail who are found to be corrupt, or is there a sensitivity to healing and moving on? There's a lot to discuss with our guests. Alena Prokopovich is an associate professor of political science at Nazareth College. Randy Stone is director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Grant Koss is a professor of communication with a focus on rhetoric at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And we're right back with that next. Coming up in our second hour, 20 years ago, the film American Beauty was released, and it won the Best Picture Oscar. Kevin Spacey won Best Actor. But 20 years later, it is routinely on the list, the short list, of worst Best Picture winners and one of the worst films in recent years. Why is that? Why have things flipped so much for that film, which seeks to have a commentary about suburban life in America? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here's a clip of Volodymyr Zelensky's inauguration. He's talking about the promises he's making, including ending corruption. Let's listen.
My election only proves that the citizens are tired of the experienced politicians who, over the past 28 years, created a country of opportunities. Opportunities to steal, bribe, and loot.
So, experienced politicians have done all of this harm, Zelensky says, and his election proves that the people are done with that. Now, in this country, we're in the midst of a never-ending Democratic primary. We could see a Republican primary, or at least an attempt to primary the president in our two-year election cycle. And interestingly enough, on the Democratic side, you have a situation where most of the Democrats are talking about some kind of mildly populist ideas or anti-Wall Street. But it's up to the voters to sort of discern what they think is authentic. And I always think that that's precarious, but I do think it's interesting because when you have Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand and so many others who talk about being anti-Wall Street and for the working people, and then they go and they raise money from Wall Street and they go to huge dinners and big plate dinners, and then you have someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who last week there was this amazing bit of sound from CNBC with Jim Cramer, which is probably just going to become an Elizabeth Warren ad, which he did not intend, in which he said he's talked to Wall Street CEOs and he's never seen anything like this, and their view is she must be stopped. I'm sure the Warren campaign's going, well, thank you, CNBC. But it's a question of authenticity. Do you actually have an intention to take some of the power and concentrated money and wealth away from the people at the top and to more people? Or do you say you will and then nothing changes? And I think that's probably what the Democrats are dealing with. And by the way, I'm not endorsing the fact that only Elizabeth Warren would do that or that she would do that at all. It was just interesting watching CNBC. But Grant, when it comes to authenticity, isn't it interesting how voters decide what they think is authentic or what they care about? I mean, you got Zelensky saying, look, they think they're tired of this. They don't want those inauthentic politicians, the established politicians. They're ready for this outsider. I'm the guy. And now all the Democrats, whether they're insiders or outsiders of the government, saying, I'm the woman, I'm the man to do this. I find that question of authenticity interesting, even if we can't sort of quantify it.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Evan, that I think like some of these other terms we've been working with in the last hour, authenticity is one of those difficult things to kind of get down kind of with any kind of clarity. There are definitely different constituencies or audiences that find different persons authentic. Personally, those individuals who find President Trump, kind of his authenticity, based on, elements of his experience I find myself kind of wondering about. But I guess you bring it back to the Democrats and the debates and and this frame. I think they are bringing on elements, I guess, this populist kind of rhetoric, this us and them, or the us is the people and the them is an elite in terms of vaguely how we think about it. It's probably more important, that I guess this is maybe just the teacher in me and critical thinking would say, look at different candidates, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, and see what kind of policies they're putting forward, and you know, doing some deeper research, and just in terms of general media consumption, to understand kind of what these plans are beyond just going after, you know, the 1%,
yeah,
you know, corporate, yeah, persons, corporate heads who, you know, receive bonuses of millions and millions of dollars. You know, look to see what plans they are kind of forwarding. And I think, just as a maybe a last point for the Democrats, they need to be points that are going to resonate not only just with their general constituencies, but some of those people who are finding President Trump to be authentic, you know, and parts of his message authentic.
Yeah, and for people who wonder, Grant, about people say, well, how could Trump be viewed as authentic? He's clearly just a serial liar. But in some ways, he speaks in ways that are viewed as beyond the pale for politics. What he's willing to say about immigration, what he's willing to say about certain social issues, are sort of what his supporters say, hey, that's what I say privately. You know, like that, yeah, guy will say it. That's what's authentic about him.
Yeah.
And that authenticity sort of rings true for them, I think.
Yes, there is. Well, I'll bring this around. This is just a personal take on Trump. I see him as kind of a guy from Queens who has many millions of dollars. Again, we don't know his tax return, so we don't know how many million, if he's really worth the billions that he states. A guy from Queens, if you put it back in the media frame, you can go back a number of decades. There was a character on television by the name of Archie Bunker, who was a guy from Queens, who went off and then just spouted off all kinds of racist, homophobic types of statements. A noted media study of the time, this is back from the early 70s, mm-hmm, people looking at the program, found persons of, I think, almost kind of an equal measure, people who were offended by that character of Archie Bunker, as well as people who identified with that character of Bunker. So, you know, in terms of where that authenticity lies, I mean, I think if you, yeah, take a base of Archie Bunker and then you throw millions of dollars, you know, of wealth, right? You get it from your father, what have you, and then you sit at the knee of Roy Cohn for forever how long, and you're in that milieu of Manhattan, and you know, you get Donald Trump, but you pull it down and you get that Archie Bunker type of character, which, you know, all the other stuff is just kind of,
yeah,
you know.
I read one year that Archie Bunker worked because liberals thought it was a commentary about how bad of a guy he was, and conservatives thought, yeah, that's my guy.
Yeah.
And by the way, that is not to say, please, I'm repeating what I read as analysis, that all conservatives feel that way.
Right.
But why that character worked. And
yeah.
So Randy, I mean, when I look at sort of what's happening in the United States in this primary election, I see those same kind of themes in so many places around the world with these elections on who is authentically going to represent people and what it means to be elite or anti-elite or willing to take it to the elite. Does that get tired for you, or do you think we do have, at least, is there, you know, historically, can we point to some cases where we go, yes, here's an election, pick any country in the world, where this was someone running on a populist sort of mantra, and it worked out pretty well. They were not corrupt. They represented the interests that they claimed to be. Or does it all sort of feel like, in the end, they become what they despise? I don't mean to be very cynical, but...
That's interesting. I mean, I think if you look back to the early Polish elections, the transition period, I think Tadeusz Mazowiecki was authentic. He was an elite. Everybody knew he was an elite. He was running against the communist status quo and wanted to bring about rapid economic reform. He said it was going to be painful. I think maybe he was a little bit optimistic about how long the pain would last and so forth. But he pretty much delivered what he intended to deliver. And he was running against, you know, the elite, the communist elite in that case. Well, there are some cases I think you can point to where someone comes forward announces that they're going to carry out an economic platform, and then they do pretty well at it. But there are temptations in democratic politics to promise more than you can really deliver. And then when things go badly, you know, to try to come up with some other promise that you can make, or to kind of gamble for resurrection, as we call it in political science. Those gambles often don't turn out well. Right. So I think there are forces in the political system that tend to lead politicians down these paths. In terms of sort of your discussion about what is authentic and not authentic, I mean, it is astonishing, I think, to Democrats that Donald Trump can promise to represent the economic interests of the American, middle and lower middle class, and then in fact do exactly the opposite, right? And it does. That seems just astonishing that can work politically, and many of his voters continue to believe that he's been acting in their interest, even as he redistributes income away from them. But I think there's also a struggle over what it is that we need to be authentic about. Right? From watching the Democratic debates, it's clear that the issue that we're trying to define authenticity or lack of authenticity on is economics. Right. And I think the populist appeal that Donald Trump has is this cultural authenticity or lack of authenticity.
Because the economics have really not mattered on his end.
Yeah.
To his supporters. Though I do think it may be a little more layered than that, because he's very effective at using the media outlets he uses to paint the picture of, oh, I would be helping you. This would be getting better for you if not for. And it's usually the forces that he is painting as some sort of monster under the bed. And I think that largely they've decided to accept that. Fair?
Well, so for example, farmers, right,
yeah.
are doing very poorly because of the trade war with China. And many farmers are taking a long-term wait-and-see attitude. Well, perhaps this will actually benefit us in the long run, right? And they're willing to do that because they feel some affinity for him on other issues, I think.
It's fascinating. How do you feel about questions of authenticity? And in particular, do you think that the Ukrainian electorate cared very much, or did they want to sort of break the system as well? Was this more a referendum on Poroshenko and less a referendum on an authentic leader?
That's a difficult question. I think voters, just to start back with American politics, I think voters have a lot of calculations that they're performing in their heads, whether they know it or not. Authenticity is one thing that they might be looking for. Intensity of effort that the candidate, and if then later president, might as a challenger to Trump might extend. Electability is the simple one that a lot of Democrats are looking for. So I think authenticity is one of them, but not everything. Now, in Ukrainian elections, many analysts have said that this was a vote as much for Zelensky team and Zelensky himself as it was the vote of absolutely no confidence, of deep critique of the Poroshenko years. I agree to a certain extent, but not fully, precisely because although Zelensky is an atypical populist, atypical compared to Europe, atypical compared even to North America, the United States, he nonetheless could, in a roundabout way, tap into what a lot of populists are being united by these days. And that is a certain type of nostalgia. So make America great again, bringing back the ideas of national sovereignty and Brexit, or going back to before the European Union and Brussels bureaucracy mm-hmm. existed. These nostalgias as a part, or in Russia, an extreme case, some kind of combination of Soviet and Imperial Russian nostalgia. In Ukraine, we cannot readily point out to the nostalgia for certain more authentic time that could have existed. But if you think hard enough about it, Zelensky made himself as a comedian in a somewhat simpler time, at a time when Russia and Ukraine were not yet at war, where the questions of Russian language and Ukrainian language, Russian identity, Ukrainian identity, European Union versus authoritarian Russia were not as sharply drawn as they're now. And so he himself can personify certain nostalgia for time past, and he could be seen as an authentic representative of a certain time period in which things were simpler than they are right now. He could, personality-wise, commitment-wise, language-wise, upbringing-wise, be an authentic representative of something that some voters wanted after Poroshenko.
And 30 seconds, forgive me for being this reductive, but do you find yourself more hopeful or less hopeful now after this election?
I try to keep a reasonable amount of hope that the international context and challenges in which Ukraine exists will contain whatever threats of populism might exist in this new leader and the new party. I hope that structural constraints will keep us on the productive path.
Well, I mean, Randy Stone's right. You go back a year, I was going to say 5 years, but even 1 year ago, it would be almost impossible to predict where we are now in Ukraine. And that's why it's that's always right. interesting, at least, to have expert observers and people in various forms of expertise to help us out in understanding it here. So, Elena Prokopovich from Nazareth College, thank you for being here as always. Let's talk again
soon. It's a pleasure.
Randy Stone, Director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Thank you, Randy.
Glad to be here, Evan.
And Grant Koss, Professor of Communication with a focus on rhetoric at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He's not making class great again. It's always been great, though. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Appreciate your time. More connections coming up.